All right, so we're starting this month exploration around consciousness, the next link in the cycle of dependent origination. So those are new tonight. We're going through this 12-month process of looking at this very detailed map of how we create this sense of me, this sense of I, and also how we create this quality of suffering, this quality of struggle and dis-ease in our very relationship to life. So it's the Buddha came up with a very detailed, elaborate map of how this whole process works. And so we're taking each step at a time as we go through, but I also like to connect the links together so you start to see how they build upon each other. Now, if you look at some of the more traditional representations of the cycle of dependent origination, they have these lovely little pictures or images representing each of the links. So the first link is that of ignorance. And that's depicted often as someone who has lost their sight, someone who is blind. And that represents the lack of clarity, lack of not seeing how things really are, the sense of stumbling through life. Now that condition of ignorance then sets the stage for the next one. That's of the sankharas, or the volitional impulses. This image is that of a potter throwing a pot of clay. And so there's the combination of creating something, putting someone's energy into something, and also the momentum of that wheel. And so sankharas, or these volitional impulses, have this momentum from our past history, our past actions, the past ways we've been reactive or responsive, all start to shape how this very moment shows up. Okay, so the ignorance and the volitional piece is like the past actions. And then that comes into the present. And the first link in this present one is of consciousness. So consciousness is often depicted as this monkey that's in the tree going from one tree to another, or looking from one window to another. So the sense of consciousness, sense of looking, of awareness, keeps flitting from one thing to another. Doesn't have a steadiness, doesn't have a quality of wisdom or discernment. So this word consciousness, we have to just step back for a second and unpack that, because there's certainly the ways we think of it in our culture, like you're unconscious, you're conscious, you're present, you're awake. Of course, there's this whole spiritual thing that we add to consciousness. And sometimes we talk about it as this higher state of being. Also, sometimes it's used to refer to this fundamental sense of knowing, this fundamental sense of awareness, which is really at the root of all experience. And yet, in dependent origination, we actually talk about it in a more simple, in some ways more ordinary way that we often overlook. But even though it's very ordinary and simple, it still has a very profound way of shaping the very perceptions that come to us. And based on that shaping of the perceptions, we act from that misunderstanding, often colored by ignorance. And you can see as we go along that this link becomes a very critical piece to this whole cycle of selfing, of creating the sense of I, of me and mine. And tied to that intimately is this sense of suffering, this sense of dukkha, this sense of mental angst, this mental resistance that we so often struggle with. And this is both when unpleasant mind states arise and pleasant senses of being arise, but also when those pleasant states end. You know, when things are going really well, and when that finally leaves because of the conditions no longer are there, we suffer in that way too. So it's really looking at that sense of identity, that way we take form as self. Now there's six types of consciousness we can look at. That in itself is kind of interesting. Just adjust that for a second. These six types of consciousness, because usually we think of consciousness as just one thing. I am aware of what's here. I'm awake or I'm not awake. But the Buddha actually parsed it out into six different areas. So the consciousness of sight, of hearing, of the nose, of smell, of taste, of touch of the body, and also of thought. Thought in itself is the sixth consciousness. So eye consciousness, which is dependent upon eyes and form. So again, this is an obvious statement that we so often overlook. That for us to be able to see something and perceive it, we have to have eyes that work. And we have to have something to see. And then we have to have also be paying attention just to actually to notice that. Same too with ear consciousness, dependent upon ear and sound. So sometimes, you're listening to me, but maybe you're not hearing the other sounds in the room or outside, or you're not sensing what's going on in your body. So often our consciousness focuses on one of these at a time, and perhaps maybe a couple are predominant. Other ones or other aspects are forgotten. We're not awake to. There's nose consciousness, an awareness dependent upon the nose and smell, aromas. Tongue consciousness, dependent upon the tongue and flavors. You can't taste something if there's nothing to taste, right? But if you're not paying attention, you're not awake to that. You can taste, eat a lot of food without even realizing, not even noticing the texture or the sensation of eating. Body consciousness. This is one of the ones we're most familiar with as meditators. It's dependent upon having a body that's working, and also something to touch, something to sense, internally or externally. We spend much of our attention resting on that, cultivating that body consciousness. And finally, intellect consciousness depends on the intellect and the mental qualities, thought to arise and for us to know it. So in the meditation, I try to give a little sense of that, we can pick out on an object like sound. We can perceive it, we can receive it, work with having non-resistance to it. And yet there's also the very subtle faculty of the very knowing of that sound itself. Again, this is so immediate we take it for granted. So learning how to kind of parse it out takes a little bit of subtlety, a little bit of stillness to start to notice that. The very thing that's perceiving sound. The very thing that's perceiving the breath, the body sitting on the ground or on the chair. The very mind that is thinking. So you see how it's a stepping back from the object of attention to the very sense which is receiving that. And sometimes we point to in meditation this much fundamental knowing, this fundamental sense of awareness, which holds all the senses and all the moments of experience. And an aspect of that is this more narrow aspect, the one that just knows of sight, that just knows hearing, that just knows taste or smell. So as you reflect on this, there's, of course, a very obvious quality to that. But if you reflect more, it starts to depersonalize it in some way. Instead of me thinking, me feeling, me sensing, me smelling, tasting, seeing, we start to see there's this consciousness that has to be present. And we start to realize we're not so much in the driver's seat. We should assume that I am actually feeling this. I am sensing it. But in dependent origination, the consciousness precedes the sense of self. What really happens is that we didn't create this sense of knowing, it actually created me. From that point of contact, we create this whole sense of self. Okay, this is how the dependent origination unfolds. Also, it's interesting if you look at those six things, six senses or six consciousness levels, we all usually focus on the mental quality of consciousness. If I'm awake and thinking, that's all there is. But to rest in the very sensing of smell, of hearing, of seeing, and to start to hold them both, all six, equally. instead of the bias that we usually have toward the thinking mind, to also hold the feeling body, actually the tasting knowing equally. So by doing this, we start to see how this becomes this first piece of this cycle of dependent origination from this point of moment, is what I mean by the first point. Because that kind of the past history of our ignorance, the past history of our actions, shapes how we perceive this moment, shapes our consciousness. This becomes this jumping off point into suffering, into creating pain and lamentation. I know this is kind of a subtle piece here. Well, later on we'll make it a little bit more concrete, hopefully. The Buddha described this process as really creating the world. It's a really interesting statement. Creating the world through our consciousness. How this is the first step in that creation. So in one sutta, the Buddha used an abbreviated version of this dependent origination, starting with consciousness. It's called the world from the connected discourses, Loka Sutta. And he starts by saying, I'll teach you the origination of the world and the ending of the world. That's kind of a stark statement there. You know, the start of the world, what arises from the world, and how the world ends. You know, the first part sounds pretty good, right? Be nice to create a world, but what about this ending of the world? What is that about? It can sound terrible or fatalistic. This is really a tough concept for us until we understand what he means by world is really this whole framework of suffering. Okay, to make this really concrete, you know, next time you find yourself in a state of reactivity and a sense of emotionality, fear, sadness, anger, sense of identity, you know, I am X, this is my job, this is my role as a caregiver, as a parent, as a partner, as a spouse, as a retired person, whatever role I take, you know, and especially when I take a quality of emotionality in charge with that, I've given birth to myself in that moment. Have you ever noticed how those, you can have different mind states throughout the day? That you might wake up in a good mood and then change into a sad mood or an angry mood. Depends on the conditions. How does that work? This is what dependent origination maps out for us. It's not just this haphazard thing. It actually has these causes and conditions from one to another. So just to share a few pieces, brief pieces from this sutta. And what is the origination of the world? It's dependent upon the eye and forms. There arises eye consciousness. So eyes that work, something to see, the consciousness that knows. From that, from the meeting of those three, we have this point of contact. Okay, contact is later on in this dependent origination. It's this point of actually knowing something, sensing something, tasting something. From the point of contact, we start to go into feeling. We start to want it. Or actually, we first start to say, is this is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? From that point, then we go toward it. We go away from it. And pretty soon, we create this whole sense of, I need to do something with this. I need to fix it. I need to get more of it. Make sure it doesn't leave me. To use the technical words, from contact as a condition comes feeling, from feeling as a condition comes craving, from craving comes clinging, from clinging comes becoming, from becoming comes birth, from birth there comes aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair comes into play. This is the origination of the world. Right? This is the origination of the world. How we create this sense of world, the sense of who we are, in relationship to everyone else, how we create this, the sense of identity. And the ending of this world is when we don't crave, when we don't go into that quality of clinging. So another way to view this is if we find ourselves caught in a moment of reactivity, a moment of charge, we can actually kind of reverse engineer this process. You can start to see, well, what is it that triggered this? What is that caught this cycle of reactivity? It didn't just show up. It feels that way. But it actually showed up through reaction to something else. We sensed something. We heard something. And then from that point, we reacted from that. And it started with consciousness being inclined in a certain way, shaped in a certain way. This is often how the Buddha would present dependent origination, doing this kind of reverse engineering. If this arises, then that will arise. If that doesn't arise, then this won't arise. So the homework for this week is, it's kind of a challenging, because of its subtlety, around trying to see this. And we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. So let's try to unpack this. This is a little heady so far. So consciousness really creates this world that we live in, this world that we inhabit. So both figuratively and also literally. You know, figuratively in terms of our response, the way we see things, certainly mentally. But remember that our minds become forerunners of our action. We think something and then we act from it. Right? We think of building a building like this and we create the building. We think about our jobs and we manifest it through our actions. So consciousness, in some ways, is simply what do we pay our attention to? What are we able to be aware of in this moment? Which aspects of those six areas of consciousness are we tracking right now? And which ones are left out, which are not included? So let me give you an example to help make this a little less obtuse. And this is an experience that you may have shared with me. So a few years ago, we went on a vacation, my family and I, and we rented a car. One of those little Fiats. And, you know, we had fun exploring that and feeling that new kind of car in our experience. When I came home, suddenly there was Fiats everywhere. You know, have you ever noticed that when you had something new in your life and suddenly you start to see it everywhere? You know, and what happened? Did I somehow magically manifest all these people buying Fiats? You know, it's not that I changed the world, but my perception of the world opened up to something I was unconscious of. I didn't really notice Fiat's, you know, just not something I keyed on. But by having this prolonged experience with this car, I was able to notice, I started to notice, it became more aware to my sense. My senses opened up to it. So there's a sense of blindness before. The consciousness was blind to that aspect, and then it suddenly became awake to it. Another way to say it is the consciousness became sensitized to this element. Right? So we go through life, how many times do we not see something? Because we don't register it. We don't acknowledge it. This is the way our consciousness is kind of biased, is shaped around that. Now consciousness, it's not a neutral thing. It's not something that is universal either. You know, what we see, what we sense, what we pay attention to is fundamentally based in our past, in our history, in our conditioning. You know, what we were taught by our parents, what we were taught by our culture, our society to pay attention to. So it's something we've added, it's shaped by that history. This is what sankharas do. Our past actions, our past impulses shape the very way we perceive the world. And it literally shapes our mind, opens up to us up to some areas and closes us down to other areas. This is part of the process. Now, our consciousness, this sense of how we perceive the world, is really affected also by filters of intention, filters of bias. So if I choose to focus on a particular sense gate or aspect of the gate, I close myself off to other things. This is one of the elements that we use in meditation around developing concentration. It's like, okay, just focus on this one, pull this one aspect of experience out, like the breath, or like a phrase, like a mantra, or perhaps the body sensations. And everything else you release. You're intentionally turning down your consciousness just to focus on this one thing. Everything else you let go of. So we essentially become a little blind to them, a little oblivious to those. There's a study that was done, I don't know how long ago, but I first encountered it at Kane Hall, just over here at the U. And for those of you who are at the Daylong, I'll repeat this story. It was presented by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is one of the pioneers in bringing secular mindfulness into the research realm and to how it can really help people with chronic pain. So I forget what he talked about, but I do remember this example he gave. So he showed this little video clip, and it was of these people, these research grad students playing basketball. So they're bouncing the ball and passing it to people. And he said, okay, look at these six people. I want you to notice everyone who's wearing a blue shirt, how often they pass the ball. Okay, and the other people were wearing red shirts. So we watched the clip for 5 minutes. At the end, he asked, well, how many times it get passed? So, you know, being a good student, we could say, you know, 20 times or something like that. Then he asked, was there anything unusual about that clip that anybody noticed? And we're like, no, I didn't see anything unusual. And he showed it again without asking us to count the passes. And in the middle of the clip, this guy in a gorilla suit walks in and goes like this and then walks off. I mean, it's as clear as day. But you just, because our perception was so focused on this one thing, we ignored this other element. Now, this is an example of how consciousness is shaped by our intention. I'm choosing to focus on it. Our intention can be conscious or unconscious. It can be, we can be fully aware of that or not aware of that. And how often do we go through life just not seeing those gorillas that walk through our life, because we're not attuned to that, we're not paying attention to that. And much of our role as meditators is learning to take those biases off our attention, to be able to see life much more directly, much more fully, with our normal biases. Sometimes we use it to our advantage. If I want to develop the steadiness of samadhi, of concentration. But often it is more of a limitation. So intentionality, there's another way that we really shape our consciousness. And this is in terms of our biases. Our biases, our preconceptions, based on beliefs, based on conditioning, what our parents taught us, what their parents taught them, the people we grew up around, give us a set of assumptions of what's normal and what's not normal. What's the right way to do something versus what's the wrong way to do that. And you know, you rub up against this all the time when you have a person who's, you know, a simple example is when I first started to date my wife. You know, what do you do around Christmas morning with presents? So my family, it's like each person gets one present and we open it and everyone attends to that opening. And then the next person opens and then we kind of go around in a really, you know, slow, you know, attentive way. And her family is like, it's a free-for-all. Pretty soon, like in 5 minutes, everything is open and you have no idea what happened anywhere. And it's just a different way of what is right. What is the right way to do it or not way to do it? Okay, so there's that bias that we have projected on the present based on our history, our conditioning. Now, the sense of bias, of course, has some really significant ramifications for ourselves personally and for our society. One very painful aspect of this is the racial bias. you know, based on our conditions, we look at someone who's other than us, and there's this perhaps sense of fear, of sense of diminishment, of sense of not being equal to. And you take that with law enforcement and African Americans. The Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention, there's a statistic that black people are four times more as likely as white people to die because of an encounter with law enforcement. Okay, so four times more likely to die as a result of that interaction. And this is this racial bias, which is has this lethal consequence. This shaping of consciousness predisposes a reactivity, predisposes a way of, in this case, lethal force escalating much faster than necessary. So at point of contact, if you don't have that as a background, you just see the person and you see them for who they are. You know, there may be some pleasant liking or not liking, but there's not this charge of reactivity that can come on. And so this is something that we all have. You know, no matter what, where we, how we describe ourselves, what our experiences are, we all have this quality of bias. Right? So learning to recognize it, to see how we shape our consciousness. Shaping our consciousness is actually shaping our world. It's shaping whether we see fiats or gorillas. It's shaping the very way we perceive life, perceive ourselves in that life. Another example of this bias that shapes consciousness, I reflected on during the recent impeachment hearings. And you know, not making any kind of statement about which side is better or not, but noticing how that sense of bias, okay, the side that I resonated with when I heard that side speak, I was like, yeah, that's right. And when I heard the other side speak, no, that's wrong. How could they say that? And I could imagine people on the other side of the aisle were having the exact same reaction, just out of sync, perfectly out of sync. Every 30 seconds, they would have a different way. Okay, so we can argue like who's right and who's wrong, and there may be some, you know, there's certainly relativeness to that. But from a dharmic standpoint, the real issue is that sense of bias, that sense of consciousness that predisposes us to react a certain way, to say, I agree with you, I don't agree with you, just because you have a D or an R after your name. You know, that's that predisposition. Dependent origination shows us that whole mechanism. That consciousness starts this whole cycle. That once we make contact with hearing, in this case, our reactions already pre-charge, it's like it has this amplification to go into reactivity. Reactivity means going into the sense of me, a sense of righteousness. How does it feel to be upset at the political world? You know, it has this unpleasant quality of that sense of selfing. And you have two senses of self identified by these realms, and there's this polarization, this lack of being able to communicate, to connect. Another element of this consciousness bias is what's called the negativity bias that we often speak about these days, that our consciousness itself is hardwired based on our evolution to highlight what's wrong and dangerous in our world. Okay, so that's this DNA that was passed on by our ancestors. The ones who were paranoid, who were reactive, were able to run away from danger much more quickly than the ones who were like laid back and just smelling the flowers. Right, so the ones who ran at the first sign of danger were able to pass on their genes, and that's what lives in us. Right, so this, our consciousness itself tends to highlight what might be wrong externally and internally. I mean, just reflect for a second. What's the rough ratio of your, when you talk to yourself, of positive things and negative things? Is it 1-to-1? One good job, one bad job, or is it much higher and the negativity, that self-criticism. So this shaping of our consciousness, of our sense of what we perceive, what we pay attention to, is very much driven by our ignorance, driven by our sankharas. It's like we create a virtual reality in the midst of this reality. That this is the rules of that. This is what I pay attention to. This is what exists. This is how I am. This is how you are. This consciousness shapes the very container of the mind. It's not neutral. It's not neutral. We could have the same sensory input. Now, some of us may not even notice it. Some of us may like it. Some of us may not like it. This is because our consciousness isn't neutral. It's shaped by our history, by our sankharas. And so Dharma practice is about learning to clear away those biases, to clear away the reactivity, to clear away all that sense of distortion, the dust over the eyes, so we can see life fully and directly. It doesn't mean we don't have reaction, we don't have preference, but we're able to see that without having to become lost in it. We're able to hold people who are different than us with an open heart, with a sense of connection. We learn to free the present from our past. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. Before we open to any questions or comments, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the practice and reflection for this week. So this topic of consciousness is very subtle. You know, it's not as concrete as some of the other aspects. And so the guidance for this week is to notice when you're feeling reactive, when you're feeling emotional. It could be big, could be small. And try to reflect as you feel that. Step back a little bit so you don't, you know, not getting so caught in the state that you can't observe what's going on. And just notice, reflect what may have triggered this. What may have started this whole cycle of reactivity? What point of contact? Okay, and it might be any of the sense gates. It might be something you thought, might be something you heard, something you saw, something you smelled, something you taste, something you felt in your body. If you have a pain and you suddenly have this sense of reaction, it's because you felt that. If you hear about the spread of the coronavirus, you know that, and you feel yourself in fear from that, trace that back to that hearing. Oh, I heard that. Okay, so I'm not putting any kind of. It's important to do this work without the sense of judging how I should be or shouldn't be. That judgment just kind of creates this level of secondary tension. It obscures really what is seeing. It really diminishes the ability to see very clearly, because that in itself is another shaping of consciousness. Right. So noticing back to what is the thing that triggered that. Right. So that one point of contact. Now here's the subtle part: is when you kind of identify that point of contact, see if you can notice the sense of consciousness that was able to perceive that. Okay, so you only got six to choose from. Okay, was it if I was hearing, it was the hearing consciousness. See if I can get a sense of what that is like. Right, this is subtle again. Just what is it that knows sound is arising? What is it that knows sight is coming into the eyes? What is it that knows touch, taste, smell? Thought. What is it that knows thought? And here's even more subtle. It's noticing how is that consciousness shaped that led to that reactivity. You know, what shaped that quality of consciousness? What's that sense of edginess, of like a spring-loaded trap that set the stage for that one point of contact for this whole reactivity to rise. Again, not judging your fact that you're reactive, not saying if I was a better meditator, I would not be reactive. It's just simply about learning to understand this process. So I'm trying to, by this homework, trying to make a very experiential sense of this process of becoming, tracing us back to that point of contact and the point of consciousness. Does that make sense? All right, so I'll be curious to see how that lands over this next week as you report next week. So do we have any comments or questions about this subtle thing called consciousness? Anybody conscious out there still? Even now as we sit, can you get a sense of that, whatever you're feeling inside, whatever you're focusing on, is there the hearing consciousness? Is there, maybe there's an emotion coming up, or a sense of unease about the silence? Okay, what is it that knows that? That's that quality of consciousness. So often, consciousness arises, and we quickly jump to the end that's me hearing, me sensing, me having this experience. Right? So dependent origination is simply showing there's actually a number of steps before that. We're sort of slowing down this almost immediate response.
So when we're paying attention to an emotion that comes from hearing, like the example you gave of hearing something about the virus.
Yes.
Do we also pay attention to the things in our past that have caused similar fear, and that's why that fear is arising in that particular way? In the same particular way it's arisen in the past that would have absolutely nothing to do with the virus but have to do with with that.
Yes, I think that would be a very helpful thing to do. And so I think people heard that okay with the mic, but just to make sure I paraphrase your comment well, is that going back to that, you know, from the reactivity or the emotion, noticing the point of contact and then noticing how it's shaped, consciousness is shaped, is it also noticing kind of what our past history, which is predisposing us to perceive that way. That's actually probably more accessible than the point of consciousness, to start to notice that, well, you know, I'm just kind of, anything I hear about that virus, like I'm kind of hypersensitive. So the consciousness is really open to that. Okay, well, why is that? So going to the body, feeling the sensations, feeling the emotional quality, and say, oh yeah, this ties into something that has nothing to do with this virus, you know, based on my history, my experiences. That's the power of the sankharas shaping that. Seeing that in itself starts to change it from being unconsciously driven by ignorance and delusion to being driven, you're starting to bring wisdom to it. You're starting to bring knowing to it. And you're also, by doing that, we'll get into this more a little bit later on, but it fundamentally, let's see if I sum this up very quickly. So the past conditions of our actions, our choices, kind of primes us to experience life in a certain way. So that's ignorance and sankharas. How we experience life in this very moment is kind of, again, pre-primed, I don't want to say predestined, but it kind of, there's a tendencies. Okay, so part of this whole moment includes consciousness, includes next month's name and form, includes contact, or sense gates, includes contact, feeling, vedana, pleasant or unpleasant, and going into clinging. Okay, so that all happens like almost instantly. But that sense of clinging, we can start to sense that. We can see that sense of pleasantness, unpleasant, and a sense of movement toward and away. When you actually go toward this deeper level, what's driving it, you're fundamentally starting to shift that quality of clinging. Okay, that's very significant because that is the next step into becoming identified, taking form as I'm the worried person. And even more importantly, by doing that, you start to undercut the power of that happening again. Become like we have these deep grooves. You kind of jumped out of that groove by doing that, and the groove becomes less deep. There's this other groove that starts to come forth. And so I think that's really a helpful process, is to notice that, you know, the past is shaping how I perceive this moment. And then sometimes it is very concrete, like, wow, you know, that this experience really biased my attention, the way I perceive. And so you start, and hopefully by doing that, you also start to become less personally attached to it. It's like, wow, it's like I'm a wind-up toy. It's like you wind me up enough, I'm going to pop up. You know, and it's, instead of me, oh, here I am being reactive again, we start to actually bring compassion to it. It's like, wow, there's this, you know, this is a hard experience, or this is a shaping experience, and it makes my nervous system, it makes my very mind perceive life in a certain way, right? And so if that right condition comes in, then, you know, that reaction comes, which is also, I think, a powerful way to start to release this cycle of suffering. Yeah, thank you. Hi, Lauren.
I'm still having a little trouble with sankharas.
Yes.
Now, the way you explained it today was that ignorance and sankharas kind of together are from before and kind of set the stage for the way consciousness and contact and all those other things are going to go forward.
Yes.
Kind of how they're going to be manifested. So, are sankharas, well, I read somewhere that sankharas, that formations, are they the only formations that we're subject to? Because they're pretty unwholesome. Or are they? Are sankharas, just because they're based on ignorance, they will be unwholesome and will lead to more unwholesomeness unless we change it?
So is your question around, is sankharas always unwholesome?
That's one of the questions.
Okay,
yeah.
And what's another question?
It's actually why sankharas come before consciousness and what's going on that we're not conscious of, but it actually seems like it's producing it seems like it would need consciousness to manifest, sankharas themselves. Mm-hmm. It seems like they're ways of behaving, kind of automatic formulas or something, like...
Their habits, their tendencies is part of that.
Yeah, I just don't get the order.
And so there's...
And I don't get, is there something else? It said that what I was reading is that formations are, you know, something that happens that's creative. Everything is a formation, mental formation.
Yes.
Yeah, and I just am having a hard time with it.
And the first part of your question was about, the positive, they're always negative. Okay.
Yeah.
So sankharas, you know, perhaps like with the five aggregates, that's one way of the sankharas show up as this kind of cluster of who we take ourselves to be.
Right.
You know, has, you know, sankharas, has form, has perception, has vedana, and I think consciousness. So those five kind of come together to the sense of self. So one way to, let me see if I can stumble my way through your question. So one way to proceed, to think of it, and because there's a bunch of elements in your question. So sankharas, what's a favorite food of yours?
Donuts.
Okay, so let's say you're driving around and you're a little hungry and you see a donut shop. Okay, so because you like donuts, you're going to notice the donut shop. You've had positive experiences eating donuts in the past. You've enjoyed the taste of them. They've been satisfying. So those past experiences kind of prime the pump to want donuts in the future. Okay, so you're going around. There's a hardware store. Who cares about that? There's a record store. Who cares? There's a donut shop. Whoa. You know, your attention goes to that. Okay, so why did your attention go there, you know, versus another? You know, if someone was into carpentry, they're like, they have a reaction around the hardware shop, you know? And so, and if they were had celiacs, they'd say, I don't want to go to donuts. You know, I have an opposite reaction. So it's like our past choices, our past experiences kind of make our attention kind of primed for that, right? So there's that tension, okay? Now, here's what's interesting is that, so let's say you stop and get that donut and you're enjoying it, and let's say you have, you know, a baker's dozen all at once, you know, because you just really love donuts. And so you just keep eating and you kind of get lost in that. That action of craving, of following that, is actually becomes the sankharas of the future. Okay, and the times you've done in the past, the times of craving become future sankhara, you know. So it's kind of this interesting back and forth between future and past. So in other words, how you act in craving right now, in the future that will become a sankhara that will shape your attention.
Right? Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, that does.
Okay, and so that's why the sankharas, it's like a priming of what we're going to pay attention to.
Okay.
If you never experienced a donut in your life, you'd be like,
right.
You know, there wouldn't be any, the conscious may not even notice it. If I've never even noticed a Fiat in my life and I suddenly see them because of my experience with that car, that's why it's like I'm become sensitized to it.
Okay.
Now, your other question around is it always based in ignorance? Is that always part of that? And in dependent origination, that's usually how it's presented. But Tanasara Bhikkhu, who does a lot of the translations I use because they're really easy to get online with the Access to Insight website. One of his many books he's written talks about the positive sankharas. Okay, so every time you sit down and you decide to make a choice to not become lost in thought, but to connect with your present moment experience, that's a volitional choice. That's an action. Okay, that's forming a positive sankhara. That's inclining your mind toward more stillness, more wakefulness, more compassion. So that's, you know, sankhara is again a volitional choice, volitional actions.
Okay, that answered my question. Thank you.
Okay, phew. She gives me tough ones sometimes. Any other tough ones or easy ones?
I'm not sure if this is a tough one or an easy one, but I sort of have this model of kind of nested Russian dolls. Mm-hmm. So you have maybe the innermost doll is sight, sounds, you know, sensations. Then you have wrapping that, I guess, consciousness, which is sort of making sense of those. And then wrapping that is maybe the deeper awareness. So I'm using kind of a non-personal awareness that maybe can see your consciousness. And it seems like the sense of self is that one of those inner dolls that thinks it's the end of the line.
Yes.
But then there's a deeper, you know, not personal self that's behind it. So I'm not sure if that's, if you could just comment on that.
Sure. So the what are those dolls called? The Russian nesting dolls. There's a name for them. But that's, you know, that's again, there's ways of looking at this from kind of the suffering side, what creates our suffering or creates our struggle. And so there's certainly that process you talked about can happen unconsciously, that we just kind of go from that point of contact to our knowing it and then reacting to it. But the way you described it was much more of this almost intervention that we do as Dharma students, as practitioners, is starting to learn to meet the moment's experience with something that's outside of the moment. What I mean by that is that instead of me being lost in my reactivity, I'm able to know that I'm being reactive, able to know that I'm having a breath. And so, and you can even know that sense of identity, that sense of self that's having that reaction. So in that way, it has that nestling quality. That's true. If that sutta for the world sutta, the Buddha talks about, you know, what's the ending of the world? So, okay, there's eye consciousness, then there's contact, then there's craving. And then he says from craving, then there's a remainderless cessation and fading away at that very craving. Okay, so right there, that's where that dropping away happens. Now, with the place where this analogy breaks down, though, is that we can have more and more subtle senses of self which are watching each other. You know, one teacher described it as, you know, how you have those two mirrors facing each other, and you look at that and you see yourself going off into infinity. So, like, you can see, and I've done this in practice, it's just trying to get a sense of, okay, where am I? Where's the sense of me-ness, the sense of Tim here? So I get a sense of that. But then if I'm observing that, something else is observing that. So, okay, what is that? And it just gets more and more subtle. And it can get very quiet in there, but there's still this sense of something observing something else. There's still this sense of subtle separation, of subtle friction. Okay, so that's, you know, a very thin little nestling doll there. But yet the practice, when this the way the Buddha often talked about the cessation, the remainderless cessation and fading away. Okay, that's when there's this fundamental dropping away of any sense of separation, any sense of me experiencing this, even how subtle it is. Okay, so then suddenly everything, this whole thing falls apart. You know, so you still have the contact, you still have the priming of the sense gates to feel and see and hear. There's that quality of maybe bias that comes in. But it doesn't lead into this sense of self, because that's seen through. Sometimes that's just a moment of seeing. Sometimes it's a much longer sustained. Sometimes it becomes a permanent shifting of deep perspective. Does that make sense? Yeah. This whole dependent origination is really about this creation of self, you know, and how that mechanism works in a very, very detailed way. You know, and some parts of it are really helpful and very accessible. Some are very subtle, like, you know, what is that sense of me observing, me knowing? And as we did the meditation this evening, going from, you know, hearing consciousness to feeling consciousness to thinking consciousness, and if you're able to kind of relax into that sense of knowing, you may have even relaxed into a deeper sense of knowing which holds all of those. And that deeper sense of knowing, there's the sense of self is not so active. It's much thinner, as Rodney said a few weeks ago. All right, any other comments or questions?
Could you talk a little bit about where fabrication, in your view, comes into this whole play, about how in essence, really, we're fabricating everything that we think and that we do? I mean, yeah. That we're really fabricating everything. How do we How do we work with that?
So when you say talk more about fabrications in terms of that, the second link, or just in general, how we fabricate?
I think in terms of the second link. Well, yeah. In terms of dependent origination, I suppose I don't know really where it falls in when I think about it. Yeah,
so sankharas, we can also translate it as fabrications or as mm-hmm. volitional impulses.
True. Yeah.
And so it becomes this... I like the word fabrication because it has this sense of I'm creating something from nothing. Right. You know, I'm creating something, and what I'm building it from is my past, you know, history, my past reactivity, my past choices, impulses, all those things come. I shape it. I create this fabrication, this sense of something, and that we paint that upon the world. We paint it upon ourselves. You know, you can look at something. I mean, how many of us have meditated and you just find that the outline of the body becomes less distinct? There's not a sense, such a solidness of my body if I'm not thinking body, 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 but actually going to the direct experience of it that starts to fall away. That's the shift of seeing through the fabrications to seeing directly into this moment's experience. And that happens, you know, in lots of ways, like if, you know, with your partner. I mean, if you're ever able to just, you know, just listen to that person outside of your history around them, without outside of your, you know, all the things, all the years you've been together, to actually hear them in a very fresh, immediate way, you're setting aside your fabrication.
What a great thing that would be. Just do.
Yes, and we practice that every time we sit, ideally. You know, we sit down and we don't realize this, but we're kind of loading all this fabrication in that very process of sitting. I'm a meditator, you know. You should meditate. You know, whenever we have that kind of, I think, you know, I'm a little better than you because you don't meditate and I do. You know, whenever you feel that, or that sense of, you know, that sense of identity around that. And just even the very technique that we approach. You know, so sometimes before you sit down, see if you can let that go. You know, I like to try to instruct us, catch us before we start to meditate, to actually acknowledge the sense of knowing that's already present before we form into the person who has to stay on the breath, who has to deal with the hindrances and fight with this and that, or be skillful or open to anatta or whatever we're intended to do, to actually meet life very directly. And so this is a very immediate practice. You know, each moment we are manifesting in a certain way. You know, and we often like that or don't like that. That's part of the fabrication. This is how I have always been. This is how I always will. That's part of the power of the fabrication. And that's why as meditators, and I imagine many of us have noticed that we start to be able to live a little bit differently than we usually have lived. We find ourselves saying things or doing things that were outside of our comfort zone before, because we're loosening that sense of identity, that sense of what the rules are of how I should be. Yeah. Anyone else?
Well, I just want to say something about, I guess my trouble with Buddhism is it's got so many lists and numbers of mm-hmm. things. Yep. And it's the same way with dependent origination. I always felt it kind of intimidating. And I guess my reaction is it's not that complicated. It's got to be much, much simpler, yeah, accessible to anybody. So I don't really, other than that, I mean, I guess that's sort of my... I'm not saying it's not valuable to investigate it through, like, the exercises you suggested.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's just my first thought that comes up is this is all much simpler than that. It you know, so that's all I have to say.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. So the comment is around the complexity of lists and how that sometimes can lead us into to viewing the practice from a complex mind versus you know, really understanding it's ultimately much simpler than that, much more immediate. I think that's true. It's like there's, you know, sometimes the lists can be helpful to kind of make sure we're not leaving something out. You know, like something like the Eightfold Path, there's eight links in there. But if we get to the middle three and realize, oh, I actually have to pay attention to how I speak or how I act in the world, that brings that quality of consciousness to it. But I think, you know, it's ultimately more helpful to be, this is my bias, of being a practitioner and seeing it immediately than being a scholar. Okay, so that's just one opinion, but it's certainly been what's been helpful for me. And I first did many years of practice before I started looking at the lists and the details of those lists. Being informed by the practice, I could see it became an alive process. And so just very simply, this simple essence of this is that, you know, what... what has to be in place for the sense of self to arise? And when that is not in place, how the sense of self doesn't arise. Okay, when there is this, then this will arise. When that's not there, that won't arise. So that's the ultimate, that's a very simple way of summing up the whole cycle of dependent origination. That for the sense of self to arise, what is present? And it doesn't have to be some list, doesn't have to be all these things we've been talking about. It could be just a felt sense. It could just be an inclination. Ultimately, that is. It's just an inclination of separation, a delusion of separateness, of identity. Yeah, so keep finding the simple path. Yeah. All right, so thank you for your questions. I know this is a subtle, maybe challenging topic, and we'll have a few more talks and explorations, so hopefully we'll start to make more sense as we go along. All right, try this homework. You know, pick out a few times of reaction and see how that, if you can sense that consciousness and seeing the bias of that consciousness. All right, so we have a little bit of a few announcements, and then we'll ask for some rides. So thank you for your attention.